From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
America first, and the rest of the world. Hello again, I'm Marvin Alney, and this is To the Point. North Korea's latest missile firing gives President Trump and 19 other national leaders still more to talk about as they meet this week in Germany. Already on the agenda, free trade, Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, his relations with China, and a face-to-face with Vladimir Putin. Massive protests are already shaping up for the G20 summit in Hamburg, where Chancellor Angela Merkel was born. As the stage is set for the next phase of world leadership, we'll get a preview. Later on today's Talking Point, the heroin crisis in Palm Beach County. That's President Trump's backyard. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. On his second trip out of the country as President of the United States, Donald Trump will go from Poland to the G20 summit in Germany, bridging the gap between the new and old Europe, just one of several diplomatic challenges we'll hear about today. On our Talking Point, across the bridge from Mar-a-Lago and other Florida mansions, so-called sober homes are luring young addicts and bilking insurance companies. One city commissioner is telling parents they're sending their kids there to die. First, this news update. North Korea calls yesterday's launch of its first intercontinental ballistic missile a glistening miracle. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says it's a new escalation of the threat to the United States. President Trump has tweeted, "So much for China working with us, but we had to give it a try." Sung-Yoon Lee is professor of Korean studies at Tufts University. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It would appear that the president has given up on asking China to do something about North Korea. Do you think he's right?
I don't think he should entirely give up, but he should, at the very least, break loose from the self-spun spell that China is on America's side, that China will do the right thing and rein North Korea in. Simply put, China has very different strategic interests from that of the U.S. China is right next to North Korea. China is perfectly fine with a North Korea that's totally dependent on China for food and fuel with a few nuclear weapons. So it was wrong, it was misguided in the first place for the Trump administration to base their hope on North Korea policy, delegate it to China, and depend on China to do the right thing.
Okay, so how serious is the threat to the United States from this new development of technology by North Korea?
This is quite an ominous development. It's a landmark, a watershed event for North Korea, and they're celebrating, even jeering at the Trump administration. They did it on U.S. Independence Day, of course, and that's no coincidence. North Korea has been working very hard toward advancing their nuclear and long-range missile capabilities, and they do this not because it's a hobby or out of perversion or it's a lifestyle choice for them. They are compelled to do so because the U.S. is the thorn in their long-term existence. Not that the U.S. is at any point gearing up to invade North Korea, but the fact that North Korea has to cope with, compete with, a very successful, a far more legitimate, prosperous, free Korean state across the border, that would be South Korea, of course, means that for North Korea to survive over the long term and perhaps one day prevail over South Korea, North Korea has to be able to credibly threaten the United States to blow up, nuke a major U.S. city and get the U.S. troops out of South Korea, get the U.S. to downgrade the alliance with South Korea, perhaps even abandon South Korea as the U.S. has done some decades ago, And then North Korea would be very well positioned to extort more aid, bully South Korea, and have its way. That's their ultimate goal.
But wouldn't hitting the United States with a nuclear missile be suicidal for North Korea? They wouldn't be able to wait around afterward and take advantage of the of what had happened, would they?
That's right. And I believe they are not crazy in a conventional sense. They are certainly not suicidal. What they try to seek is to be able to pose a credible threat by graduated escalation. They won't just come out and say, we're going to nuke you, you know, so oblige us or else. They will do it in a credible manner of step-by-step escalation. And when that threat becomes credible, it will be a very difficult, a deep moral dilemma for any U.S. president. What do I do? Do I defend South Korea against North Korea's threat? And do I honor my treaty obligations to a key ally in Northeast Asia? Or do I think of the lives of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens first?
How is that more of a moral issue for the United States than having Pakistan or India or some of the other nuclear powers be armed as they are?
Well, Pakistan, India, you know, that's a volatile situation there in that region, of course. But in the case of North Korea, North Korea, I believe, is really the only country that has walked away, gotten away with blatant killings, egregious killings of U.S. servicemen over the past six decades. There has never been a military retaliation against North Korea's countless attacks, and these have been small scale, but there have been instances of North Koreans shooting down a U.S. spy plane and killing all 31 servicemen on board. And cases like that have never triggered a military response from either the U.S. or South Korea. And what that means is probably it was helpful in maintaining the peace, de facto peace in the region, unstable but real peace. At the same time, the U.S. has to admit it has conditioned North Korea to assume that it can get away with murder.
Okay. Obviously, then, we have a very serious problem to cope with, more serious today, perhaps, than it was yesterday. Sung-Yun Lee, thank you so much for being on our program. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Professor of Korean Studies at Tufts University. In a moment, America First and the rest of the world on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Donald Trump ran on the repeated promise of America first, and the rest of the world is still anxious about what that might mean. Tomorrow, he'll make a speech in Poland, and on Friday, he'll be in Hamburg, Germany, for the latest G20 summit with the leaders of the most powerful nations on Earth. Matthew Karnishnig is chief European correspondent for Politico, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start with Hamburg. You're going to be there starting tomorrow. Why is Hamburg such an important place for this meeting, given the fact that very close to where the G20 will be meeting, there is a sort of headquarters for ongoing protest?
Well, Hamburg has also been historically Germany's gateway to the world. It's a mercantile city and really benefits from free trade and is a liberal city. And I think these are the messages that Angela Merkel and the Germany wanted to send with this city as the place for the summit. It also has, as you noted, a somewhat liberal tradition, and we're going to see that on the streets. We're seeing it already today, and that will continue in the coming days. And I think that the Germans are quite happy about that as long as these protests don't turn violent, which is what everybody is really worried about at this stage.
Why are they happy about the protest?
Because I think it shows, or they would argue that it shows that Germany and that Europe encourages dissent. It's part of a democracy. It's part of the debate, and you need to have people out there speaking their voice and being heard. So it isn't something that they would really discourage. It's all, this being Germany, it's all done in a very orderly fashion. These protests are registered ahead of time, and you know, they generally tend to be peaceful.
What about the concern with regard to the United States pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord? Will that be part of the protest? Will President Trump be a target of protest?
Yes, on both counts. I think that President Trump will definitely be a target of the protests, but that certainly won't be the only focus of the protests. You have groups from really all walks of life, I would say, who are going to be protesting. You have people protesting against Paris Accords, because many people think that they haven't gone far enough, for example. You have people protesting against inequality around the world, especially in the developing world and in the third world, people protesting poverty and so on and so forth, and war. The Syria crisis is still very present here. So you have various groupings who all have their own hobby horse, as it were. Today you had 1,000 people marching through the city dressed as zombies to protest what they feel is the sort of the apathy of mainstream society when it comes to dealing with these global challenges.
All right, Matthew Korniejczyk again, chief European correspondent for Politico. Let's turn to Poland. That's where the president's going to be making a speech tomorrow night. Dalibor Rohak is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. It's good to have you on our show.
Great to be with you, Warren.
How important is this speech to Poland, and why Poland?
Well, for Trump, the choice of Poland is quite natural. President Trump is singularly unpopular across Europe. 87% of Germans don't trust him. 90% of Swedes don't trust him. But the government of Poland does like him. And that's in spite of the fact that Trump himself is quite unpopular in Poland itself. Only 23% of Poles have confidence in him, according to a recent Pew poll. That's half the number of Angela Merkel's. And so he needs a friendly audience. Polish government promised to provide that. And Polish government needs friends in high places, internationally speaking, because there has been this standoff over the past 2 years over a number of different issues between Poland and the leadership of the European Union in Brussels, be it over asylum policy and, more importantly, over the question of rule of law in the Republic of Poland.
Why is it that Poland is so different from the rest of Europe, and has it become considerably more conservative as far as the government is concerned than it has been in the recent past?
There were important elections that took place in Central Europe over the past couple of years, and in Poland and in Hungary, aspiring authoritarian populist governments took power. And what they are doing is that they are essentially dismantling checks and balances, basic safeguards of the rule of law, cracking down on civil society. And they've been, in fact, encouraged by President Trump's election in the United States. So it's really very important what sort of message the president sends to both the governments and people in that part of the world, because if he sends the wrong message, he can contribute to further division in Europe. He can contribute to the drift of these countries away from the ideals that that underpinned their transition away from communism after 1989.
So is Mr. Trump seen as somebody who is eroding checks and balances, who is in fact cracking down on civil society?
That was very much the perception. In Hungary, after President Trump's election, Viktor Orban, the prime minister, said that this gave him an opportunity, that this election gave him an opportunity to essentially clean up the country of foreign-funded non-governmental organizations. There has been a crackdown, especially on financing coming from George Soros. And that's a trend across a number of countries in the region. And there is this style of politics that has been emboldened, I believe, by this populist wave that swept across the United States last year.
Dalibor Rohak, excuse me, with the American Enterprise Institute. Back to Matthew Korniejczyk on his way, I should say, to Hamburg, as was just mentioned, the president did not make a very good impression when he got to the EU the last time around. Do you expect that he will make statements tomorrow that will, in fact, separate Europe or have a tendency to separate Europe, new and old?
Well, it feels a little bit, to be honest, that the mood music over the last couple of days has been more in the direction that Trump is going to try and make this meeting a success. That's certainly what he said after speaking with Merkel a couple of days ago. And one has to wonder what really his advantage would be of antagonizing the Europeans again in particular and the larger global community here. He's made his positions clear on the Paris Accord. The U.S. has already pulled out. So, you know, just from a strategic point of view, there might not be really much for him to gain again by focusing on that issue. He keeps saying that the president, that he wants to have fair trade for the United States, that he supports free trade, but that he wants it to be fair. The United States has repeatedly threatened over the past several weeks that it was going to impose tariffs, steel tariffs, on European countries, on the EU. It hasn't done so yet. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if this meeting is not as confrontational maybe as some of the past interactions we've seen between Trump and the international community.
But Dalibor Rohak, you said the president has to be very careful what he says in Poland before he gets to the G20 meeting. What's your worst scenario? What are the risks that he has in addressing the Poles?
Well, it's really a double-sided question because on the other side of the table, you'll have Europeans. And there is an election in September in Germany, and there is a lot of pressure on Angela Merkel to get confrontational with President Trump. And there are lots of cheap political points to be scored by confronting Trump, for example, over the climate issue, or by criticizing him, or by trolling him. And that's a real danger because that could push Europe and the United States on a trajectory where the transatlantic alliance would be weakened and would eventually unravel. Yet Europe still very much needs the United States.
Another place which, of course, has also had a recent election is France. Manuel Lafont-Rofnil is a senior fellow and head of the European Council on Foreign Relations Paris office. Good to have you on our program.
Good evening.
What about President Macron, and how is he going to receive President Trump, do you think? Is he at one with Angela Merkel, or do they have different interests?
No, I think he's much more one with Angela Merkel than he will play different interests. The interesting thing is that there are clear issues on which France and the U.S. do not agree. Climate change is one, of course. But there are also issues on which U.S. and France are trying to find a kind of a more positive common agenda. They've talked recently over the phone on Syria and the use of chemical weapons, for instance. And more importantly, President Macron has invited President Trump to attend the 14th of July parade in Paris next week. So there's definitely a willingness to circumvent the point of disagreement, not to avoid them, to face them very clearly and quite frontally. Macron's reaction with Angela Merkel and the Italian prime minister after Trump withdrew from the Paris Accord was very clear in terms of, we disagree with that, we think it's a bad decision, and we're going to stick and stay committed to the Paris Accord and to climate change policy. But there's a willingness to find issues and topic on which there can be better relations and narrow cooperations. The problem with this G20 meeting is that the agenda is not very favorable to this kind of more positive attitude. Whether it's climate, trade, migration, these are all issues on which there are big disagreements, and Macron will obviously side with Merkel on these topics.
Let me ask you this. It's Bastille Day that he has been asked to attend. Apparently he's going to come back to the United States and then go back to Europe for that event. In the meantime, how concerned is Macron, how concerned are others in Europe about President Trump and his America First policy?
Well, there is a lot of concern, and there's a lot of concern on many topics. The climate is one that has been very much discussed, but last time President Trump came to Europe, he first attended a NATO summit, NATO leaders meeting, and there are also concerns in Europe, Western Europe and Eastern Europe, on security guarantees and the role that the US want to play in the world, whether it's vis-a-vis Russia or in the Middle East or in face of terrorism. There are some doubts and questions about the kind of role that the US want to play and the room that it is looking for Europe to occupy, what it expects from Europe. But trade, migrations are other topics. And last time he came to Europe, I remember this debate about, does America first means America alone? Is this a kind of a new version of American unilateralism where the US do take their own decision and behave based solely on their own interests? Or will there be a way for the America First policy to be a policy which is connected to other partners and a kind of a more cooperative or coordinated policy? Well, that was before Trump decided to withdraw from the Paris Accord on climate. And therefore, the odds of America First being a much more difficult partner for Europe in particular are obviously stronger today.
So, Dalibor Rohak, what is your take on America First? And does it suggest that, as you pointed out earlier, he could, particularly when he's in Poland, but then perhaps even when he's in Europe itself, in Western Europe, I should say, he might give Angela Merkel and others reasons to be confrontational?
Well, look, it's fair to say that the transatlantic alliance is not in a very good state. And it's not all just Donald Trump's fault. It's not just about America First. But part of a longer trend. There was this disagreement over the Iraq war. We had 8 years of an administration of President Obama, who was quite popular in Europe, but who still displayed very little interest in European affairs, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, and he left a vacuum there. And the French have not forgotten President Obama's failure to act in Syria in 2013. And on top of that, you get a president who is unpredictable, who is very outspoken about acting in a very narrowly defined national interest, and who is not very popular in Europe. So the downside risks are there, but I think all sides need to work together, because there is at the present time no substitute for America's role in the world, for the commitments and alliances it has forged over the many decades. So we very much need Americans at the table. We as Europeans, if I may say so.
Matthew Karnishnik, again, you're chief European correspondent for Politico. Do you feel that Europe needs the United States, or can the EU go it alone, whether it's about climate change or anything else? Matt, you gone? Are you still with us? Okay, well, let me split the same question to Mr. Rob Nui. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't think it's Europe alone. I think it's the rest of the world. And that is something that will be interesting in the G20 meeting. Will the other countries from Asia, from the Middle East, from Africa, from Latin America, for instance, confirm their commitment to the climate change policy? Will they confirm their interest in free trade rather than fair trade? That is something that will be interesting to see.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break. On our talking point later, the heroin crisis in Palm Beach County, President Trump's backyard. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about President Trump's second trip overseas. He is already on his way to Poland, where he'll be making a speech tomorrow. Then he'll go to the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. Many countries there, obviously. It's the G20. Then he'll come home, and then he'll go back to France for Bastille Day sometime next week. Let me introduce Steve Clemens. He's just joined us, political and foreign policy analyst. He's also Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic. Good to have you back.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Do you agree with what was said a moment ago, that President Obama left a vacuum in Europe, didn't pay much attention, particularly to the eastern part of Europe, emerging as it is from the years of Soviet dominance? Is that a fair statement?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I have respect for everybody you have on the show, but I think President Obama worked with nations in Europe in a lot of big transnational problems, ranging from, you know, trying to solve some of the economic malaise issues hitting Europe, dealing with a lot of the terrorism hits that were happening throughout Europe, dealing with climate change and building a broader global social contract for that. And then, of course, at the Warsaw meeting in Poland of NATO, President Obama was the one who signed off on redeploying U.S. troops into Poland and into other parts of Eastern Europe. And so that happened there. And, you know, that did not happen under Donald Trump. That happened under President Obama. So that man portion, when I interviewed the foreign ministers of Hungary and Poland at what they call the GlobeSec conference after the last NATO meeting, both of them love Donald Trump, love what he communicated in Brussels at the NATO meeting that he went to, while there was a lot of consternation elsewhere. And they said, look, we see U.S. troops deployed. Well, those U.S. troops are deployed there because of President Obama.
Well, what about President Trump, though? He's speaking in different terms than President Obama. How different do you think he really is, and how will he be received, do you believe, when he gets to the G20?
Look, I think that the G20 right now, the nations that are big and matter in the G20, the G20 is largely focused on broad economic issues, but there's just no way to avoid the fact that North Korean missiles and ICBM has gone off. People are worried about which direction the U.S.-Russian relationship may go, which has enormous security implications. There's a tension and fragility in the Western alliance today. Doubts about the solvency of alliances with the United States and concern about the behavior of President Trump. No outline at all of what America's strategic objectives would be in discussions with Vladimir Putin. Everyone is tense. And so this has created a changed board, if you will, a changed game set for every leader in the world that looks at the United States as the primary driver of good global things. And right now, that's in doubt, to the point where Angela Merkel in the past has said it's clear Europe needs to move on. And I have to tell you that while all of this is going on, guess where Xi Jinping is right now? He's in Berlin. He brought two pandas to Berlin for the Germans. He is having an extraordinary meeting with Angela Merkel in Germany. And in a way, while I think it's more posture than substance at this moment, Xi Jinping and China are positioning themselves to be the responsible global player and potential partner in Europe if the United States defects from those roles on protecting global markets and protecting the world from the effects of climate change.
Dalibor Rohawk, back to you with the American Enterprise Institute. It was you who said that President Obama left something of a vacuum in Europe. What do you say to what we just heard? And does that suggest that China has a real opportunity there, whether it was created by President Obama or President Trump?
Well, it is true that for many Europeans, the United States is no longer the only game in town. And that's something that should, I think, worry us, because the alternatives to the United States in Europe are not necessarily liberal democracies. To the question of whose fault is it, I really see this as a continuation of a longer trend. President Obama's policy towards Europe was largely reactive, starting with the reset with Russia, with the scrapping of the Missile Shield project with Poland and the Czech Republic, and then really a feeble reaction initially to Russia's aggression against Ukraine. President Obama expressed at multiple occasions his frustration with allies. So I think there is difference of degree, certainly, and difference of style with President Trump. But the broad substantive direction of U.S. foreign policy has been not that dramatically different. And I think that is what has contributed to this drift in in transatlantic relations over the years.
Back to Matthew Karnishnig, you're again a European editor for Politico. Do you see more similarity or more difference between Trump and Obama?
Well, I agree that both have been somewhat reactive. I mean, certainly, you know, Trump has taken a more belligerent approach to the NATO question, although his core problem there, that the Europeans aren't paying their fair due, is nothing really new. It's something that we've heard, in fact, for decades from various American presidents. It's just the way that Trump goes about presenting his arguments, I think, that people have objections with. And, you know, in terms of Obama, he came into office talking about pivoting to the Pacific. That was a message that, you know, was heard loud and clear in Europe. It was something that they worried about from the beginning, that they probably overreacted to. At the same time, you know, as was mentioned, when Russia moved into Crimea and into eastern Ukraine, the U.S. was caught completely flat-footed, and everyone has been sort of reacting to that since then. And Obama really left it to Merkel to deal with this crisis, and quite frankly, the Germans have not really been able to. Everyone was ill-prepared, which is why you have this sort of frozen conflict there that you do. So I don't think anybody has really been covered in glory here when it comes to dealing with European security. And the question is, what happens now with Trump? He clearly has a better relationship, or it appears that he might, with some of the Eastern European countries, in particular Poland, which is why he's gone there. But that's not going to be enough. He's really going to need to bring Germany in particular back into the fold if he sees it in the U.S.'s strategic interest to have a good relationship with Europe. And there's some question about that at the moment, to be quite frank.
Steve Clements, back to you. Again, a Washington editor at large for The Atlantic. Given the possibility of setting up the possibility for Angela Merkel to be confrontational if she chooses to be. She's up for election. People in Germany, as we heard earlier, don't like President Trump at all. 80% are said not to, according to one of our earlier guests. Do you think President Trump will be conciliatory when he gets to Europe, and does it make sense for him to be that way?
The truth is, I don't know. I'd be completely speculating here. I think he's got there's a fork in the road. If he has decided in advance that the biggest thing that he wants out of the G20 meeting is a warmer relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russia, and that he wants to continue the track of, you know, putting a thumb in the eye of the global social contract on climate change and continue to flirt with a new round of provocative trade actions that threaten the global trade order, because to many people in Europe and also in Asia, Trump comes off as a neo-mercantilist, shaking down allies, shaking down trading friends to distort markets and to get, you know, supposedly more investment or better deals for the United States in the kind of transactional way he sets this up. Angela Merkel has said her two chief goals in this meeting are to maintain the global compact on climate and to protect and preserve the infrastructure for free trade and global markets in the world. And Donald Trump right now is not a friendly player in either of those objectives. So I think the tone will be set by Trump there. If she sees him backing off that mild calm, which is, you know, we've never seen him really do that, then perhaps she will respond in a conciliatory way. If he makes this all about Vladimir Putin, then I think she's going to make this all about China, and that China is the one who is the growing power in the world, the promise of potentially taking on, in partnership with Europe and other nations around the world, some of these real public goods challenges in the rest of the world. And that's what you see in the German press today, is the kind of preceding tone setting for that, which is something I've never seen before in any of these summits. And I think, as one of your guests just said, China is not a liberal order. It is an illiberal regime, but it is, you know, benefiting from the wake of doubt in the United States and Donald Trump that we see in the world today.
Back to Manuel Lafont-Ropneil. You are senior fellow and head of the European Council on Foreign Relations Paris office. How do you see this, and what do you expect from President Trump, given all we've heard?
Well, first, I don't think China is going to fill the gap, and I don't think the Europeans are waiting for China to fill the gap. One of the things that Macron said when he invited President Trump for Bastille Day is that the relation we have with the U.S. is a long-term one, which basically means the relation we have with the U.S. will survive President Trump. And what we need to be doing now is also to build something that will be useful if and when the Trump administration ends, and that there will be an end to that administration. Hopefully, there will be an end to its policies with the next administration. And therefore, there's no desire to hand over the keys of the world order to China, whether it's on trade, whether it's on climate, whether it's on migration, whether it's on security. There is, on the contrary, the idea that we need to salvage what can be salvaged. It's not about antagonizing or isolating Trump. Trump's choices and decisions are isolating the U.S. by themselves. The one thing that the Europeans are trying to do is to salvage what can be salvaged from that world order that we are trying to build, whether it's on substance or on the way we do it, which is cooperation and a rules-based order. And the initial agenda of the German presidency of the G20, which was about financial regulations, about a compact with Africa, about fighting transnational crime, the German presidency has had to put that on the side and focus on defending what was there already and we don't want to be backtracking on, which is climate, trade, and the other topics that we've discussed. So there is no will to be antagonistic at all. There's just a decision, a determination to preserve what we believe is in Europe's interests.
Steve Clemens, back to you. You mentioned whether the president might, in fact, be looking for warmer relations with Vladimir Putin. They're going to meet personally for the first time. There's much discussion about who will be best prepared. Vladimir Putin, of course, having long experience with these kinds of exchanges, President Trump having none at all. What do you think is liable to come out of that? And when you say if he tries to be warmer with President Putin, what do you mean?
Well, I think Donald Trump has a fascination with Russia and is clearly comfortable with Russia in ways we haven't seen presidents be in a long time. But that doesn't mean that the infrastructure of the United States and strategic policy and course and direction of the United States, particularly after Russian hacking of the American elections, Russian misbehavior, harassment of our diplomats, and Russian behavior militarily around the world, is something that can just be winked away in a meeting. But I think many people that we know around President Trump have clearly expressed his desire to reset U.S.-Russia relations. What is find alarming, and maybe this is untrue, but you know, H.R. McMaster and others, you know, I have a lot of respect for the president's
H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor,
right.
He's still a member of the military. Go ahead.
That's right. General McMaster is a complete professional, complete pro. He understands national security decision-making process, the importance of bringing the principals, the other cabinet members and intelligence agencies, and thinking through a roster of what America's objectives ought to be. I hope they've gone through that process and that they're putting a sheet in front of President Trump, probably a one or two pager given his preferences, but that there is something that his government and his excellent staff have put together. Because what we're hearing from HR and others is that the president is going to guide this conversation in the direction that he wants to take it, that they really don't know what the agenda is. So they're either covering up the fact that there is a plan, or alternatively, there isn't a plan. And if you take the latter, if President Trump is just winging it with Vladimir Putin, who is coming in with very clear objectives of what he wants, and I think he may put on the table all sorts of things that he might like to offer Trump, either on Syria, on cooperation, on energy issues, but in exchange for things that I think ultimately end up weakening the Western alliance. And I think that is the element of this that's disconcerting to some to so many, and also doing a full bilateral meeting where this is not a pull aside, this is not a casual, reads as if Vladimir Putin is getting a gift from the United States after some pretty malicious behavior towards our country and our citizens and to our allies.
Matthew Karnichnik, do you think that the European countries are, in fact, very concerned, Western European countries, very concerned about Mr. Trump and Vladimir Putin and how close they might be in terms of friendship, policy, and other respects?
No, I don't, to be honest. I think that they would welcome it, in particular the Germans, because they've always seen dialogue as preferable to confrontation when it comes to the United States and Russia. So I think that any signs that Putin and Trump are speaking and are working towards what they might regard as some kind of constructive dialogue would be welcomed, both by France and in particular by Germany, which even during the Cold War, you know, was famous for this policy of Ostpolitik, as they.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. We're running short of time. Manuel Lafont-Ropny, do you agree with that?
I'm not sure. I think, obviously, the idea that there is a dialogue is a good thing. But what Trump came in with in terms of maybe lifting the sanctions or throwing Ukraine under the truck in terms of recognizing the annexation of Crimea is not really the kind of policy that the France or Germany wants to see the U.S. pursue. So, and on top of that, the idea would be that the U.S. and Europe should have some kind of coordination in their attitude towards Russia. It shouldn't be just unilateral or bilateral decisions by Trump and Putin without consultations of Europeans to decide the fate of Europe. So, yes, supportive in terms of being dialogue, pushing for dialogue rather than for confrontation, but up to a point only.
Dalibor Rohak, seconds left. Your take on Trump and Putin.
Well, the real suckers in that whole process would be the Central and Eastern Europeans, the Poles, who are now looking up perhaps to Trump and hoping for America's security guarantees. And if there is this warming up to Russia, they would be the first ones, that region would be the first one that would be thrown under the bus.
Well, thank you all very much. That's all the time we have. Dalibor Rohak, once again, is with the American Enterprise Institute. He's speaking to us from Paris. Manuel Lafont-Ropny, also in Paris, senior fellow, head of the European Council on Foreign Relations Paris office. Steve Clemens, again, political and foreign policy analyst, also Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic magazine. And Matthew Karnichnik, again, chief European correspondent for Politico. Many thanks to you all. In a moment, corruption and deadly drug use in President Trump's backyard. To the point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Allen here with today's Talking Point. In the Palm Beach, Florida Post reports that the parents of a 23-year-old man from out of state received a $300,000 bill from a so-called sober home. Such places give residents urine tests every day at $1,500 to $5,000 each. Corruption like that is one reason that Andy Amoroso, city commissioner for nearby Lake Worth, tells parents to stop sending your kids to South Florida because we're sending them home in body bags. Mr. Commissioner, welcome to our program.
Great. Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're on the Sober Home Task Force. You're on the Heroin Task Force as well. You're pretty familiar with what's going on there. Tell us about what appears to be a sort of epidemic of sober homes.
Absolutely. It definitely is an epidemic. And, you know, our state attorney, Dave Ehrenberg's doing some great work. And the Sober Home Task Force, we've got new legislation just passed in Tallahassee. And, you know, he's already hit the ground running, trying to, you know, catch the bad guys. But it's just so overwhelming, especially for small cities like mine, city of Lake Worth, we're, you know, 7 square miles, 38,000 people. And it kind of snuck up on us. You know, we're a small cottage town. And, you know, we estimate that at any given time there's over 200 sober homes. And unfortunately, they're not regulated. And, you know, we really can't count them, you know, other than, you know, people saying we've got an issue in our backyard.
What do you mean they're not regulated? Anybody can set up a sober home?
Absolutely. Anybody can set up a sober home, and there's big money in it. And that's, you know, to be honest with you, that's, you know, the state attorney is going after the patient brokering, you know, the bad players. There's some, you know, great sober home providers in South Florida, but there's, you know, twice as many bad providers. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to catch the bad guys and get rid of them so, you know, the good ones can rise to the top and actually do the work that these young adults are paying for, or the parents are paying for.
What is patient brokering?
Patient brokering is anything that I promise you. For instance, if I promise you a pack of cigarettes, that's illegal. And what's happening on a larger scale is, you know, the AA meetings, the NA meetings. You know, I personally think, you know, if I was a drug dealer, I'd be sitting out in front of one of these meetings or the sober home because my clients are there. And that's exactly what's happening. So people are going to these meetings and saying, you know, you come stay in our house, we'll give you free rent. Illegal, illegal. Come stay in our house, we'll give you free gym membership. We'll give you a free yoga class. All that's illegal. That's patient brokering. That's promising something, and that's all illegal. And that's a lot of the stuff that we're doing right now. That's how we're catching them, you know, on the legal, you know, come stay in our house. And the purpose is that, you know, they want you to bring your insurance and your money to their house so they can make the money.
Tell us some other ways that they inflate the situation so they can make more money.
Well, you know, the P-test, the actual testing, you know, on our Sober Home Task Force, we have sober home providers, we have attorneys for sober homes, and, you know, these are the good players, and, you know, they share with us the stories of, you know, they're doing P-tests and actually looking at drugs that these people wouldn't even be using, and you know, they're not even available. So they're doing a full, you know, write-up, so to speak, of all these drugs, and half of them, you know, they wouldn't even, but they're testing for them and charging for them. And, you know, one of my biggest concerns is we're hard-pressed to get the insurance companies to the table. And why aren't they stepping up and doing their own, you know, this is, to me, fraud, and, you know, I would think the insurance companies would be concerned.
I take it law requires the insurance companies to pay for services even though they don't seem to be performing the way they're supposed to.
Absolutely, but, you know, I run small businesses, and if something smells or looks wrong, I'm going to research it. And especially with the cries from not just South Florida, but now nationally, you know, I would think that these insurance companies would start looking. I mean, we have had, I think, Aetna pulled out of South Florida. There's been a couple that have stepped up, but I don't think there's enough. And, you know, I personally think we need to cut them off at the legs where the money's coming in. And, you know, the biggest thing that they're getting is the insurance.
The Palm Beach Post describes teenage junkies nodding off on coffee shop couches, shooting up in the bathrooms of supermarkets. Why do parents send their children there in the first place? And what gives them the expectation that they're going to get better?
Well, they're you know, it's false hopes. When you're desperate, so to speak, you're looking at and you look at these beautiful things that say, come to sunny South Florida. And, you know, you take it for face value. And, you know, even here, you know, we have young adults that, you know, you call home to mommy and you say, yes, I'm doing great. Why you have a needle in your arm? You know, they can't see it. They're not seeing it. You know, even locally, I own a small business in the downtown. You know, Starbucks had to put locks on the bathrooms because there were issues. We had to put locks on our bathroom in our local libraries because there were issues. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think you mentioned it earlier. You know, my message is stop sending your loved ones and your children to South Florida because we're sending them back in body bags. And I know that's harsh, but let us figure out the problem and try to address it, which we are. I mean, we're doing great work, but it's just not fast enough. And, you know, I sit on the board for the National League of Cities, and 2 years ago nationally, they weren't even talking about it. this year, they're talking about it, and they're aggressively talking about it because now it's a national thing. Other cities are having the problem, and even if they're not, they've lost loved ones or friends and relatives to cities that, you know, again, they're coming here, and there's bad heroin on the street, bad fentanyl, and these kids are dying.
I gather heroin is cut with fentanyl, cut with other things as well, including things that tranquilize elephants and
fentanyl and carfentanil. They're elephant tranquilizers. And at first, in Palm Beach County, we didn't even know what it was. They had to bring in vets to actually identify. And you know, one day in Palm Beach County, we had over 10 ODs, and that wasn't even by the end of the day. And they actually, you know, they have to bring trailers in. You know, Palm Beach County and other cities are not ready for this. Our county commissioner, Melissa McKinley, has stepped up, and she's talked to the governor. The governor has, you know, declared an emergency. Palm Beach County has put money into it. But I still say, you know, as Palm Beach County taxpayers, we're paying for everybody else's problem.
Sure. Do the county, you know, do the sober homes, as they're called, actually provide drugs in some cases?
Absolutely. And we hear a lot of that case where, I mean, if you're clean and sober and your insurance stops paying, you're no good. You're no help to them. So, you know, we've heard horror stories where they've actually given them a little so they pee bad, then the insurance starts over. I mean, it's just a full circle.
So the insurance then kicks in when there is, as you refer to it, a pee test that shows that they are on drugs.
Absolutely.
And there's Absolutely. Just nothing you can do about. Well, what about is there a class action lawsuit possibility? Or
well, and that was another suggestion that I don't think anybody's really looked at it with the class action lawsuit. You know, these kids they pass away, they go home, and there's a grieving process. But how do you get all these parents from all these different cities in a class action lawsuit? You know, I definitely think, again, you know, it's the money. You start suing these bad providers. You know, on that kind of a level, and I think they'll step up. We've had quite a few, you know, people in the city of Lake Worth close because we're either getting close to them or they're doing something shady and they don't want to get caught. So, you know, it's working, but it's just not working fast enough.
We're out of time. Andy Amoroso, City Commissioner for Lake Worth, Florida, across the bridge, 8 miles from Mar-a-Lago. Great to have you on our program. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.